Okay, so good afternoon. Today I'm announcing that I'll be visiting the United Kingdom, Germany and Belgium from June the 2nd to June the 8th. The visit will include 3 days in London, as well as time in Hamburg and Berlin and Brussels, where I'll meet with the European Parliament representatives and representatives from NATO. While in London, I'll attend events associated with the Queen's Diamond Jubilee celebrations. I've been scheduled with British Prime Minister David Cameron and Canadian Prime Minister Stephen Harper on Tuesday the 5th, 10 Downing Street. While in London, I'll also be calling on the Governor of the Bank of England, Dr. Mervyn Kim. In Brussels, I'll meet with NATO Secretary General Anders Fogh Rasmussen and the European Parliament President Martin Schulz. I'll also launch the Friends of New Zealand group in the European Parliament. In Berlin, I'll meet Chancellor Angela Merkel, deliver two keynote speeches, and meet with various business groups. I'll also meet the German Foreign Minister. As well as representing New Zealand at the Queen's Diamond Jubilee celebrations, I hope to advance New Zealand's bilateral relationships with the European Union, NATO and Germany. The visit will also be a valuable opportunity to give me first-hand information on the issues currently confronting Europe. The European Union remains the world's largest economic bloc and our third largest export market for goods, worth around about $5 billion. I'll return to New Zealand on Sunday the 10th of June. Over the weekend, it was announced that New Zealand will be a partner in the $2.5 billion square kilometre SKA project with Australia and South Africa. It's fantastic news for the science and astronomy in our country. The SKA project is one of the world's largest science projects. We've been working on it for quite some time. It builds the world's largest radio telescope, which will be 10,000 times as good as anything built before it. While the bulk of the physical location of the joint venture Australia-New Zealand partnership will be in Australia, the result is a major endorsement of our expertise in science and innovation and will help boost our scientific profile internationally. It will likely provide greater research and career opportunities for Kiwi interests, for Kiwis interested in astronomy, physics, maths and computing. This project underlines the government's approach to the budget to science, scientific and technological innovation, which are major drivers of growth and international competitiveness. Just in terms of ministerial activity, I'll be at caucus tomorrow, of course, in question time on Tuesday and Wednesday, and Thursday I'll fly out to Europe in the evening. And in terms of the House this week, we'll make progress on the budget debate and the Crown Entities Reform Bill. The only other one point I'll probably make is that, as you'll be aware, next Monday, I think it's Queen's birthday, so that will be the day I think we're announcing the Queen's birthday on this list. Because it's the Diamond Jubilee, the Palace invited us to consider whether we wanted to have a recognition of that. So there'll be four additional members of the Order of New Zealand announced on that particular day. That's in line with what happened when the Golden Jubilee occurred for 50 years. So it's a good looking list. Update the cabinet on today, and you'll be able to see it next week.
Prime Minister, what are your thoughts on this ongoing invite from David Shearer to discuss the retirement age? Promise not to politicise it if you did get together.
Sure. Well, look, I mean, we went into the election with a fairly clear promise and mandate not to raise the age. We took the view that we didn't need to do that. In the short term, we hold strongly of that view. And really nothing's changed from that. I mean, Labour went in with a different proposition. It was really to put on a capital gains tax and raise the age from 2020 on. As I said last week, everyone can see that there's an ageing population in New Zealand. We acknowledge that. It's also true that it has an implication in a number of areas like healthcare. But in reality, despite the issues that we see in Greece and Europe in general, changing something in 2020 wouldn't actually make any difference when it comes to that issue.
So you're even reluctant for that, you know, to go down the road of that retirement commissioner's plan of not starting until way out in 2020?
Don't see any particular need to do that, no.
Yeah, why is that? What's the...
Well, we've done our modelling, we go all the way out to about 2020, that's our forecast period, and, you know, we're comfortable in terms of the numbers that we see there, and there are a number of reasons why that is, but, you know, the Treasury's done that work for us, and the significant changes are not directly related to superannuation. There are a number of other factors. Our focus is really on economic growth and lifting the economy.
But post-2020 is when it's really going to start to hit. Isn't that when you really need to start actually planning forward for that?
It may do, maybe for another day, but not today.
Well, it's quite obvious. I mean, the numbers are there about the numbers of people coming into that you know, the baby boomer bulge and the associated costs. Are you saying that, you know, that's not going to be a challenge in the future?
What I'm saying is it's healthy for the country to have those debates, and if they want to have them, and political parties will need to take their policies into the election campaign in 2014.
So you're effectively saying there's no need to do anything about superannuation in the next 10-20 years?
Does the government do any other long-term work on the ageing population generally, in areas like healthcare, aged care, dementia care, and you know, that has implications for superannuation as well?
Yeah. Well, to the best of my knowledge, I haven't seen any particular work they've produced on that, but I have no doubt the Ministry of Health is looking at those particular issues. Superannuation is just simply one of the costs of an ageing population. But they go all the way back to the fundamental point, which is if New Zealand is going to incur greater costs because of an ageing population, then that's all the more the reason why we need two things: stronger economic growth, and secondly, a balance sheet that can support any additional costs we might face, which is why we need to get back to surplus by 2015.
Did you and the Cabinet or some of the senior members of the Cabinet vote give some consideration to, you know, going back on your promise and perhaps
There are always recommendations from Treasury, and we always kept the tyres on issues, but no, there was no serious consideration.
Are you concerned at the impact these changes in education are going to have on intermediate schools and on these technology teachers?
Yeah, okay, so what I'd say there is the government is committed to trying to make a change, and that is to increase the quality of teaching and put more resources into the quality of teaching rather than the quantity of teachers. As we said last week, 90% of teachers, schools will be affected with either plus or minus one teacher, so they'll be fairly modest changes to say the least. There's a group of schools that are more affected by that, and they are not exclusively, but typically, intermediates, and technology is in there, although it's a very confusing formula, which I won't go into too much. So what the government had always agreed to do was to set up a working group. I've been working with the Minister and others today looking at that group and looking at the issues. I think it's fair to say there are some hard edges for a small number of schools, and the government is looking to see how it can take the pressure off those hard edges.
So how are you going to take
the pressure off? What are you looking at there? So are you going to roll this out over a longer period of time? Are you going to cap the number of teachers that can lose their places? How are you going to take this?
Yes, so I simply can't answer that question today, but what I can say is that for the overwhelming bulk of schools, we're comfortable, change is very modest. For some, it's more extreme. It's at, as we find, the harder end. And I think we need to look at addressing that harder end. It's a smaller number of schools, but they will probably be overly affected. And that's just a result of the fact that sometimes these formulas, when they play out over 2,500 schools, have some slightly unintended consequences.
So did you know that before you made the announcement
in
the
budget? We did, yeah. So the Ministry's always been aware that there's an impact, particularly on these intermediates, and we'd always agreed that there would be a working group. We'll work pretty constructively with those intermediates. It's not exclusively intermediates, but largely those. The technology issues, not quite right. It gets confused in it, but it's not necessarily the driving factor. The driving factor is the change in class size proportions, and where you have an intermediate, you can't spread it over, say, for instance, 8 years when you have a full primary from years 1 to 8, or a high school from years 9 to 13. So it tends to concentrate the issue, and there are one or two schools that would have significant number of teachers that would have to leave under that proposal, and that would be too many for the government, so we'll just need to work on that.
So how many teachers will be leaving?
Well, over the four-year period, teacher numbers are flat, actually. There's just not a growth in the teacher numbers. But in any one year, there's always movement, and that's because, putting to one side any changes we made in the budget, what drives the number of teachers that are funded in schools is role growth. And some schools have roles going up, and some have roles falling. So there's always movement in teacher numbers. It's just that the formula would have driven, because of the role growth over time, an increase in the number of teachers from the 52,000 that we approximately have today.
How many is too many teachers?
Sorry?
You said before some schools would lose a lot of teachers. How many is too many?
Well, you need to give us a little more time to define that fully. But in the course of time, we'll come back and talk about it.
Mrs. Pilata said that when it was put to her that the unions had said there was maybe about 1,000 job losses, she said that was not who offices forecast or who forecast. Yeah. What are those forecasted numbers that...
I don't have those numbers. You need to get them from her office, but it certainly goes down and up depending on any one given year, but over the four-year forecast period, it's flat.
So was the Cabinet not given a figure for potential job losses in the sector?
The Cabinet number that I remember is that it's flat over 4 years, but I can't tell you whether in any one given year whether it moves around. As said, it always moves around, but some years are more than others.
So you're saying there'd be no job losses effectively in a net?
On over the 4 year period, I think that's correct.
When did you decide to set up a working group?
Some time ago, before we made the announcement on the policy. I mean, the policy is broad ranging, as is always the case when you have a very big system like Health for Education. Then sometimes it drives at extremes some sort of exaggerated impact, and we wouldn't want that to take place. We overall very much support the view that having had a decade of substantial increase in teacher numbers, the time now is to focus on quality teaching outcomes. I think that's the right thing to do. We're really effectively having a cup of tea, taking stock, saying we've got 52,000 teachers, how do we overall improve the quality of teaching outcomes? I think that's the right thing to do. But there would be one or two schools that would just be overtly affected, and we need to insulate them from that.
So if you knew there were going to be some hard edges when you announced the policy, why didn't you have some measures in place to mitigate that this time?
Well, because we want to work with the sector on how we might do that.
How much correspondence does the government give in negative correspondence about the plans?
Can't tell you in my office because I literally don't see it day to day. Can't answer the question. I've had anyone specifically raise it with me. But there will be some schools who will go away and do a calculation, and there will be some schools sitting in that intermediate area that will be concerned. But I think the sector group is listening to the Minister that she's going to work constructively with them.
What schools are the leaders talking about industrial action over this?
Well, let's see. I think everybody should hold their breath a wee bit and we'll work our way through it.
When you said about technology, are there other areas that have become obvious?
No, the main factor with technology is the important thing to understand is if you look at a primary school, 70% of primary schools provide technology on site. There's effectively no change there. 30% have their kids going off-site to another primary school. And a slight change comes in the way that formula funds the child and how that might work. So technically there's not actually less money there, but it's the way the money is allocated. It's quite a complex formula. But the big driving factor is the class size ratios. And that's why in some cases, in fact, we're being more generous in funding a smaller ratio. In some cases we're funding less. And some are staying the same.
And is technology affected because of the way that's set up, that it's not necessarily on-site, regular kind of classrooms, like English and maths? Is that
I think it's because the way that the funding is going to be apportioned back to the child as opposed to the provider's school, that's the complicating factor.
Thomas, can I ask you about the Rio Earth Summit?
Yeah.
A bit of criticism about the Zealand's track record there. And can you give any consideration to going to the next one yourself to set the example?
Look, I gave some consideration I did seriously think about going to Rio Plus 20. In the end, I decided not to go. My travel commitments this year have driven off some things beyond my control, Diamond Jubilee and the likes. But what I would say is, while we acknowledge the report that was written by the World Wildlife Fund today, I actually think New Zealand's record's been pretty good. If you go and have a look at, for instance, we're a country that's got an emissions trading scheme, we're planting more trees than ever before, and every application we've seen so far for new electricity generation as a result of that scheme has come about for renewable energies. We have the Land and Water Forum, we've insulated hundreds of thousands of homes, we're aggressively out there pouring money into science and research, particularly in areas like methane and nitrate emissions. We've been putting pressure on Federated Farmers and Fonterra for clean streams and duty dairying campaigns, and we've been out there recently talking to local government about how they might see improvements.
This is a world WWF report, presumably other countries are going to read it and see it, to see a worldwide brand, WWF. Don't you need to be front-running internationally if you want to talk up our record?
Well, I'd be interested to read the other countries' report. I mean, to be perfectly frank, it's hard to believe they're going to be doing better than New Zealand. and it depends on what's driving your emissions profile. And half of all of New Zealand's emissions come from methane and nitrate emissions, and that really requires a technological solution. In that regard, we set the Global Greenhouse Gas Alliance. We've got well over 30 countries joining us, putting in, literally as a consortium, hundreds of millions of dollars looking for answers to methane and nitrate emissions. So I think New Zealand's got a pretty good record myself, and you can go and look at lots of other countries, but it's hard to believe they're doing much better.
But don't you accept that compared with 1992, our environmental position now would be worse than what it was in 1992?
Well, maybe. I mean, I need to go and take a look by category, but what I'd say since 1992 also is our population's considerably larger, so it's likely the amount of emissions that the economy is letting off, if you like, or expelling, is likely to be greater.
What are your thoughts, Prime Minister, on that remit from the Young Nats at the weekend about gay adoption?
My own personal view is that the issue of gay adoption is not a hugely significant issue. And it's not because it doesn't matter to those couples that might want to adopt children, but the truth is that less than 200 non-family adoptions take place in New Zealand at the moment. My view is actually that's quite tragic for a lot of great New Zealanders that would make fabulous parents, irrelevant of their sexuality. The whole issue is whether there are enough options for people to adopt kids in New Zealand, and actually there isn't. It's one of the reasons why the government's been working with countries like Russia to look at the adoption rules between the two countries. For me personally, I'm not that odd if there was gay adoption. I think it matters more about whether you love the child than the sexuality of the parents. But let's see how things progress.
So will you be looking to change the law, or would you support a law change for gay people to be able to adopt children?
Well, if there's a members' bill that's drawn, I'll personally vote for it to go to the Select Committee, and it'll be a conscience vote, is the way I would see it. But the government wouldn't look to put it on the government's work programme because it's in truth just not a big enough issue. It's, I understand and completely have sympathy for those people looking to adopt, but it's now such a small group of New Zealanders they're getting the opportunity to adopt that it can't be the government's number one issue when we're facing all of the other economic issues we've got.
But isn't the sample right?
Well,
sorry.
Kevin Hagen and Takaya are not just talking about gay adoption, they're talking about
that's
surrogacy.
That's how I perceive, yeah.
And that affects more people.
Yes.
And
sees more people. I haven't seen the work on that, I'm sorry.
But would you support a bill that looked at not just gay adoption, but surrogacy as well? And these are your own MPs who are trying to push this issue.
So I need to have a look at that, and I just simply haven't seen that bill. Well, it won't change what we're doing because obviously we made that public at the Chicago conference that was attended by the Minister of Defence and Minister of Foreign Affairs, but certainly we'll be talking about Afghanistan, I would have thought, and about both New Zealand's commitment and how they see the ongoing situation in Afghanistan playing out. I mean, they've been the forum, if you like, under which New Zealand has been participating in terms of ISAF NATO commitments, and so it makes sense for us to talk to them about how they see that transition, what the order of events is likely to be, what other countries are doing. But New Zealand's position is quite clear.
And yeah, is that clear with respect to a request for money, given that there was a perceived shortfall in the capacity of the Afghan defence forces, for example, once the withdrawal takes place? NATO asks New Zealand for a larger financial contribution. What's your inclination at this point?
Well, I've been reluctant to put more money into Afghanistan, and my own personal view is that we've had a decade there now in terms of the provincial reconstructions team in Bamiyan. The SAS have been there, I think, on three or four different rotations under two different governments. So my view is that we've put a huge contribution into Afghanistan. The Americans obviously are looking to build a huge commitment of resources from countries around the world. It was the Americans that suggested to us that $2 million would be a sum of money that might be appropriate, and I thought, quite frankly, that presents a pretty good value for us, so we accepted it.
Are there any specific points you think you might raise with Mervyn King?
It'll be just interesting to see how it's going. I met him last time I was over there about a year or so ago. He's quite a fascinating guy. I mean, I think it'll be just interesting to get everybody's perspective on Europe and what might happen, where they see the Greek-Spanish situation playing out, what stress they see on their economy, and they've got a, it's pretty technical because they're a minus 0.2, but a technical recession taking place in the UK. It's just been quite fascinating, I think, to get a perspective on European crisis.
The South African central bank governor last month wrote an open letter to all the governments engaging in quantitative easing, saying it's driving up their currency and our currency. Do you think that might be raised? It might be a point of this is how you're hurting us, your policies?
Last time we went to the United States, we had a much more extensive discussion about quantitative easing, obviously with Ben Bernanke and with Timothy Geithner. Look, we might have a discussion with Mervyn King about it, but I don't think the UK aren't really engaging in quantitative easing, not in the way that the United States is.
On the issue of the Kiwi Fruit, do you think that growers should be prosecuted for injecting these chemicals into their vines?
Well, we would be very concerned if they are doing that. I know some have volunteered that information that they are, but obviously if there was any fruit found that contained that antibiotic, then that fruit would be dumped and it would be damaging potentially to our international reputation. There are under certain conditions which the antibiotic can be applied, but I think it's when it's sprayed on, not when it's injected in the vines. The assurance I've had so far from the Minister of Primary Industries is that no fruit has been detected that has detected any strains of Streptococcus, I think it is. So, but we'll be continuing to monitor that. I think the Ministry of Primary Industries is looking at the wider issue about what could be acceptable levels of the antibiotic, but that's for them to work on another day.
On another issue, we're celebrating our anniversary with some from our friendship relationship between Zealand and Samoa. How would you describe our relationship at the moment?
Well, 50-year relationship, something to be celebrated. I mean, New Zealand has an enormous Samoan community living primarily in Auckland. They've been fine New Zealanders in the time that they've been here, and they've worked hard for this country. I'll personally be going to Samoa as part of the 50-year celebrations. And that friendship treaty that the two countries have has served us well. The Prime Minister of Samoa, Tuialeva, is a great friend of New Zealand. We've worked very constructively with him. And I think that real affection that New Zealand has for Samoa was very much on display when they had the tsunami back in 2009.
In aged care, you said the other day that the limit on what centres could charge was a handbrake on raising wages. Are you looking at that for a limit on charge?
Not really, but it's a statement of fact that it limits what those rest homes can charge. So in reality, they can only charge a basic rate, which is the rate they negotiate effectively through the DHB contracts, and they can only charge additionally for add-ons, such as a larger room, a non-suite or a better TV. So no, we're not looking to change that, but if there was to be a substantial increase in the pay of caregivers, and I think we all accept they're a very needy group who do great work, that's going to cost the government about $140 million, and at the moment we just don't have that cash.
So you're not looking at lifting the charge instead of that?
Well, not at this point, no.
Well, just in a scenario where gay marriage or gay adoption didn't make it, to become private members. At the third reading, would you go back to your electorate as you have in the past on these kind of issues? Or
I might do. I mean, historically, that's the way I've acted. Let's go and have a look. But I'm more than happy to have the debate on these issues. Yeah. And I might vote for them the whole way through. Everyone has a different view on marriage and what's appropriate. In my view, there's not a hell of a lot of difference between gay marriage and civil union. So, I'm not uncomfortable with civil unions of the year, but at least I have those.
Can I just ask you a final question about the super age that I asked about earlier?
Yeah.
With all these other countries, the US, Australia, UK, Iceland, all these places, going to 67, does that not make you, think, hey, I've got it wrong here?
Well, France is looking to lower this to 60, from 62 to 60, but putting that all to one side, there's a bit of a difference between those other countries, and that is they don't provide universal superannuation. So, in other words, New Zealand effectively has a commitment with our citizens to pay them universal superannuation at 65. And that is different in those countries. There's more flexibility for their workers because they tend to have private provision. Now, I think we all accept that people are living longer and some people are certainly in the workforce longer and their capacity to work longer or maybe take superannuation at a higher age would be greeted with ambivalence by quite a lot of people. But there's also a lot of people who are in manual jobs where that's just not that practical. At 65, they're still going to be in a position where, frankly, it's very difficult for them to continue to work. And we already have a lot of people who are 63 or 64 who we transition into superannuation in a form early on. So it's, in my view, just not straightforward. But the focus of attention of our government has been on economic growth. I can't rule out what future governments might do, but it's not something, even if we hadn't made that pledge, it's not something we would have been changing budget 2012.
In France, that's a measure in part to try and boost youth employment. Could we be doing that here then?
Well, our numbers on youth employment are improving, actually. The minister informs me, our net numbers are looking quite good.
But if you have more old people retiring early, you can get younger people into the workforce quicker. Would you look at that?
I don't think we need to make that change. Anyway. Okay, thanks very much.